Shrink Wrap Radio number 557, Getting the Sleep You Want, with Dr. James Alexander.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
On today's show, I'll be speaking with return guest, Australian psychologist Dr. James Alexander, about his new book, Getting the Z's You Want, Sleep Sense in the 21st Century. Previously, he was my guest on Shrink Wrap Radio episode number 397, in which he interviewed me, and on episode number 341, in which I interviewed him, on the hidden psychology of pain. For more information about Dr. James Alexander, please see our show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com. Dr. James Alexander, welcome back to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you, Dave. It's a real pleasure to be back here talking with you and being able to see you this time while we talk. It adds another whole dimension to the discussions.
That's great. That's right. We've spoken twice before. Once when I interviewed you about the unconscious roots of pain, I think, and then you turned around and interviewed me.
That was a highlight of my interviewing career.
Oh, thank you. And so now we're both on audio and video, and this will go on YouTube. And we're going to be talking about your latest book, called Getting the Z's You Want, Sleep Sense in the 21st Century. And for my YouTube audience, this is what the book looks like. It's a thin volume, but I must say, for a thin volume, you pack a lot of information in here. That's a good trick. What led you to write this book, this particular book?
Well, I guess I'm a person that has struggled with sleep probably since I was about 18 years old.
Oh, wow. That's a long time.
It is. Well, unfortunately, it is quite a long time since I was 18. But thanks for pointing that out.
We both have some white hair, so 18's way back.
I was nearly killed in a car accident when I was 18 years old. And I think from that experience, it seems to me that my central nervous system got wound up somewhat just from the trauma of that experience. And it became fairly common for me to struggle in getting to sleep at night with my mind just going 1,000 miles an hour, often waking up during the night, again, my mind going 1,000 miles an hour, unable to get back to sleep. So it's an issue that I've grappled with throughout most of my adult life. I can't remember whether I was a light sleeper before I was 18 or not. Again, it's a long time ago, so I really don't know what that was like. But I certainly know since I was 18, since I had the car accident experience, sleep became quite difficult for me, and it was mostly just my mind going 1,000 miles an hour at all the wrong times.
I've been there. I mean, I know what you're describing. Yeah,
and being unable to turn it off.
Right.
So, I guess that's the background. What prompted me to write the book this year was I had surgery earlier in the year, and probably about 3 or 4 nights after the surgery, I had what's referred to as a rebound effect from the painkillers, the painkillers, the opiate based painkillers that I was put on after the surgery. And as we may discuss later, a rebound effect is when the brain kind of fights back against what's been artificially done to it. And in my case, the opioid painkillers was kind of suppressing my brain functioning as it does. And when I was clear of those, when I stopped taking them a few days after the surgery, I had a night where I just could not sleep for anything. Nothing was going to go to sleep again. My mind was going a million miles an hour. The suppression of the opioid painkillers was no longer operating, and I was just left with the rebound effect, which was this heightened level of brain activity going on, and there's nothing I could do to get to sleep. And through that night, I sort of remembered all the clients that I've had over the years have reported the same problems, not just for one occasional night, but night after night. And, of course, I felt a great deal of sympathy and empathy for those people suffering through this long night myself. And during that night, I decided I'd write the book. I'd been meaning to for quite some time because, like all psychologists, I see a lot of people that report problems with sleep, and I've been meaning to write some kind of manual or some kind of book for a couple of years to be able to give my clients. And on that long sleepless night, it just occurred to me, now's the time to do it. So I started writing the next morning when I got up.
Well, the good side of that is that this book is written by someone who is in a position to talk about it, that you yeah. are authoritative, having lived through the challenges, as well as being a psychologist who studied a variety of solutions that you cover in the book. And so we'll be walking through some of those. One of the things that struck me was that you object to the term sleep hygiene, which I think I've read here and there when people talk about sleep problems and issues. What is it that you object to about that term, sleep hygiene?
Well, to me, just the notion of hygiene introduces a feeling of sort of sleep being a medical issue. Hygiene to me sort of equates with sterility and some kind of, to me it just sounds like a medical issue, and I kind of object to the medicalization of lots of normal areas in living, including problems in living. So I'm quite a big fan of Thomas Sasse and his notion of problems in living preferably not being medicalized.
Yes.
And so any sort of language from the medical arena going into normal areas of life, I have something of an objection to, and I find that the notion of hygiene as potentially introducing a medical way of making sense of sleep problems, where my feeling is that most of the time that sleep problems aren't medical issues at all. Sometimes they can be. Certainly we can have health issues that have a negative impact on our ability to sleep. There's no question about that. So in my book, I do suggest that if people have puzzling or persistent symptoms that are hard for them to make sense of that are impacting on their sleep, certainly go to a physician and get those well checked out and dealt with. But unless they have some kind of clear other symptoms, my suggestion is that sleep problems are probably better not viewed as being medical problems. And one of the difficulties with viewing sleep issues as medical problems is the standard medical response of simply prescribing sleeping tablets or minor tranquilizers.
Okay, maybe that's the distinction I was wrestling with a little bit, and that I think listeners might, you know, that you say, well, it's not a medical issue, but you were talking earlier about your brain. You get into some neuroscience in the book. So what's the distinction not being a medical issue and yet having to address the neuroscience?
Well, lots of neuroscience and neurological functioning is not to do with pathology, with physical pathology of body cells, which I think is the real domain of medicine. So, you know, a normal neurological functioning, to me, is not a medical issue. When neurological, you know, clear structural neurological pathologies occur, of course, that's a medical issue. But most sleep problems that people have don't relate to either neurological disorders or medical disorders. But unfortunately, the standard medical response, at least in my country, is I think it's about 95% of people that go to GPs complaining of sleep problems come away with a prescription for a sleeping tablet. Now, most of these people don't have injured or diseased body cells requiring medication, and obviously sleeping tablets aren't that kind of medication that are going to correct any kind of physical pathology. So I think there's really important implications for drawing this distinction, and for me to move away from any kind of medical terminology makes a whole lot of sense, in that it makes it clear that for most people sleep problems aren't medical issues. They can be, but most of the time they're not.
Okay. And in your mind, what's the purpose of sleep? I know that's something that's been hotly debated in psychology for a long time. We know through neuroscience, we know a lot more now. What's your understanding of the purpose of sleep, why we need it?
Well, I guess the bottom line is if we don't get it, we're going to die. So it's pretty essential for survival. Mm-hmm. It seems to serve a whole range of both physical as well as psychological functions. So on a physical level, the immune system gets a boost every time that we sleep. It appears that during the non-REM stages of sleep is when our immune system is getting a recharge. Our physical resources are being recharged while we sleep, so just the ability to rest. In terms of the psychological benefits, memory reconsolidation, so the ability that our brain has to turn our experiences and short-term working memory into long-term memories seems to occur primarily while we're dreaming. Now, I sat down with a calculator once and I worked out an average 50-year-old person has about, I think it was about 390,000 hours of being awake. I reckon I'd be lucky to string together maybe 100 hours of memory. So something else has happened to that, most of that 390,000 hours of being awake. And it appears that while we're asleep, primarily while we're dreaming, the memory reconsolidation processes, or the memory consolidation process is going on, whereby it's kind of taking out the important aspects of our experience and the gist of the experiences from our short-term or working memory, and it's consolidating the things that we need to retain into our long-term memory. So if we don't do that, if we miss out on REM sleep, we suffer psychologically. If we miss out on the non-REM sleep, we're going to suffer physically. So it's really essential for survival and for our physical and psychological well-being and functioning.
Yeah, there's been a lot of research on sleep deprivation, and that certainly supports everything that you're saying. Yeah. You know, sometimes I've stepped back from, sleep is very strange in a way, to think that everybody sleeps some of the time. And it's just a strange thought, you know, that particularly during certain hours, you know, most people are asleep. They're in this altered state of consciousness and one that we share with other animals.
Yeah.
It's a daily fact of life, a nightly fact of life. And yet if you pull back a little, it's just kind of strange that we're all sort of required. Like if you would think about robots that have to stop at some point and recharge or go over to a plug in the wall, a strange way to look at it, I admit. Maybe I needed to get more sleep last night. So how much sleep do we need?
Well, maybe like you, I was raised with the idea that 8 hours seems to be the standard recommendation. Of course, the amount of sleep that we need varies with age. So babies and infants need a lot more sleep. Young, you know, children need more sleep. Seems that teenagers still need more sleep. They need to be able to sleep in the mornings. I've got vague recollections of that. As we go into our adult years, as we age, it appears that we need less and less sleep. So there's a bit of a shifting of gears required. If we're sort of thinking that we must get 8 hours of sleep, but we find that we're kind of surviving on seven, sometimes until we get comfortable with that, we can get a bit nervous about only getting 7 hours of sleep a night. There's some very interesting research done by a professor at the University of California who's a long-term sleep researcher. He studied over 1 million people.
Wow.
And over a course of time, of course.
Yeah.
And what he ascertained from his research is that rather than 8 hours being the optimal amount of time that we need to sleep, people getting between 6 and 7 hours of sleep, that was associated with lower rates of death. People that got more than 8 hours of sleep per night was associated with higher rates of death, and people that got less than 4 hours of sleep a night was also associated with higher rates of death. So he sort of worked out that around 6.5 hours for our physical health and longevity seems to be what this sample of 1 million people suggested is optimal.
So that's fascinating, because I think most of us have heard 8 hours and are pretty attached to that idea.
Absolutely. I've long been attached to the idea that I needed to get 8 hours, but I have noticed, I'm in my mid-50s now, I have noticed in the last 5 years or so, I seem to be surviving better on less sleep. So it kind of indicates to me that I'm needing less than 8 hours. And to read this research was quite comforting as well, in that it kind of, you know, pretty well demonstrates that 8 hours is not necessary, but it seems that around six and a half, between 6 and 7 hours seems to be optimal for our health and well-being.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that really tickled me in your book is you talk about waves of sleep, of sleepiness, that we get this sort of wave of sleepiness. Well, I have, and I know that you're a surfer too, and I long have had this sort of running argument or discussion with my wife when a certain time that when I start to get sleepy, I tell her, I've got to go to bed now. I've got to go to sleep. I don't want to miss my wave.
Yeah.
Very clearly having the image in my mind of it's like surfing, even though I'm not a surfer like you are.
Yeah.
But I did grow up close enough to the ocean to have some experience of that.
Yeah.
And so I was delighted to see you talk about waves in your book, and even with a little cartoon, because that so fits my experience. If I miss that wave, if I stay up a little bit too late, then, well, I guess the research would suggest I might not get another chance for about 90 minutes, right?
Yeah, correct, yeah. Well, look, it may be an idea to read that chapter out to your wife.
Yeah, I'm gonna at least show her the cartoon and point that out. I don't think it'll win me many points, but yeah.
So it refers to that the waves of sleepiness refer to a biological cycle called the BRAC, which stands for Basic Rest Activity Cycle, which I think probably could be better termed the brain rest activity cycle, because it refers to the need that our brain has to take regular rests in regards to reducing its level of alertness. And as you said, around every 90 minutes, so the average is about 90 minutes, but the waves come between 80 to 120 minutes, and they're waves of heightened levels of brain arousal, and then slowly going back down again to lower levels of brain arousal, where our brain is basically resting for 20 minutes or so. And that's the wave of sleepiness that we can all recognize. And we'll also experience this during the day. So it's not uncommon for people to be at work and just feel overwhelmed by tiredness. And if they happen to be in the middle of a very boring meeting at the time, and I've nearly done it a few times, my head's nearly slammed on the table right in front of me. Obviously, right in the middle of the dopey part of the BRAC cycle, where a person's brain becomes fairly inactive, we become tired, daydreamy, dopey, far less alert, and the purpose of that, it seems to be that it allows a replenishment of the sodium and potassium levels, which sodium, potassium, ions are required for the electrical signaling between neurons. And when our brain is running at a high level of alertness, it's obviously chewing through these sodium and potassium ions at a rapid rate, and they become depleted. Now, in order to allow the sodium and potassium ions to regenerate back to the levels required, it's like our brain takes a bit of a break. And so that last 20 minutes of that, when our brain arousal is going down, that last 20 minutes of the downward curve is when our brain is basically kind of idling. It's taking it quite easy. There's a low level of arousal going on, allowing this replenishment of the sodium and potassium ions. And it's during that time that this is the wave of sleepiness. So this is problematic for us if we're at work or we need to pay attention to what we're doing, but it's really great to experience that wave of sleepiness if it happens around the time when you're wanting to go to sleep.
Yeah.
Now, yeah. What a lot of people do is that they will recognize, let's say in the evening they might be actively engaged in watching TV or a movie or their favorite computer game or whatever it is that they're doing. And it's not uncommon for people to push through that wave of sleepiness. It might be 10 o'clock at night. Let's say they usually go to sleep at 11. They might start to feel tired at, say, 10:30 at night. They feel that wave of sleepiness. Their brain is in that rest part of the cycle, that last 20 minutes of the downward curve. But because they're really enjoying what they're doing, they don't want to miss the end of the movie or the end of the TV show.
Right.
Computer game or whatever. They push through it. And we all know that we refer to it as getting a second wind. We know that when we've come through that wave of sleepiness, we kind of think, oh, okay, I'm through that. I feel all right. I'm feeling quite alert again. Well, we're back up into that upward swing of that arousal curve. And if that person then decides, all right, well, it's time for me to go to bed after they've pushed through that wave of sleepiness, they're going to find it very difficult to be able to go to sleep, because that next wave of sleepiness is not going to be around for about another 90 minutes or so.
Mm-hmm.
So people will often go to bed at that time and just toss and turn and build up, a higher level of frustration, start to feel anxious about what tomorrow is going to be like, start to feel anxious about being so tired and having to wake up early in the morning and how am I going to cope with the next day and all that sort of stuff. And they build up a degree of heaviness, psychological heaviness, via the frustration, and people often get very anxious about the whole notion of sleep and being tired the next day. And I know from surfing and being a middle-aged surfer now, I regularly see skinny young guys in the water that seem to do almost nothing to catch waves. They just position themselves in the right place, literally one or two paddles and boom, they're on the wave. Whereas blokes like me, middle-aged people, we have to work really hard. Well, I have to work really hard to catch a wave. And it seems to me that I'm probably, compared to the skinny young fellas, I'm heavier. I'm just simply heavier. And it means I move slower in the water. And being heavier, I've got to work a lot harder. Well, it's a similar analogy to the brack wave of sleepiness. If we have weighed ourselves down with feeling anxious and frustrated about not being able to sleep, we can be so heavy that the next wave of sleepiness that comes our way 90 minutes later may not take us with it. That's the real problem, that we may miss the next wave of sleepiness because we're just so weighed down with distress about not being able to sleep and worrying about the next day. We miss the next wave. And what happens to our frustration and our sleep anxiety? Of course, it just compounds, and it gets worse and worse and worse.
Yeah, kind of a vicious cycle.
Very vicious cycle. So, yeah. We'll toss and turn.
I notice after dinner that I get really sleepy, and I think I've heard that the blood is all being drawn into digesting food or something. So I get super sleepy, and sometimes I want to lay down on the couch and take a short nap, or I'll notice that I'm starting to nod off a little bit even as I'm watching TV. And it's again, with the ocean analogy, it's trying to pull me under. There's this real sucking thing that wants to pull me down, and I'm fighting it because, I'm supposed to watch this show with my wife. And if I go upstairs and get on my computer, it's much more engaging than watching TV. Is kind of passive, so I can get sleepy very easy watching TV in the evening, or now as I get older, being at the movies in the late afternoon.
Yeah.
If I start working on my computer, because it's so interactive, it wakes me right up.
Yeah.
But that could be a problem, right, if I work on it too much close to the next wave.
Yeah, if you push through and you miss the next wave of sleepiness, it just depends on if it coincides with when you're wanting to go to bed. So, if the wave of sleepiness hits you after dinner at, say, 8 o'clock, you probably don't want to go to bed at 8 o'clock, so it's probably not a big problem pushing through that wave. And like I said, if you're doing something engaging, it's going to be a lot easier to push through the wave and perhaps even barely notice that you're feeling sleepy because you're engaged in this activity. But if you know, if you're pushing through a wave of sleepiness around the time that you're wanting to go to bed, that's when we're kind of creating problems for ourselves. Mm-hmm. So we just need to be mindful of when is it that I'm wanting to go to sleep, and being sensitive to what's going on in our body, and trying to be aware of the wave of sleepiness that most coincides with our bedtime, so that we're not pushing through and missing that wave.
Yeah. You know, the sodium-potassium balance, ion balance that you were talking about, is that based on fairly new research? Because I've not run into that before seeing it in your book, and I've read a lot on sleep and dreams and so on.
In all honesty, I can't remember where I got that from. I researched a whole range of different sources of information, and unlike the first book that I wrote, The Hidden Psychology of Pain, where I referenced that very thoroughly, I've sort of since looked at books for popular consumption, and I've noticed that they don't bother with heavy-duty academic referencing. Sure. And so I thought I'd just simply join that trend. And
yeah, sure, I understand. I just I was actually delighted to because it was new to me, I thought that, boy, that's a nice little gem of information. Something that I hopefully can retain.
If you Google BRAC, the Basic Rest Activity Cycle, you'll find that there's loads of information that, and that's where the mention of the sodium and potassium ions.
Okay. You talk about another set of cycles. You know, we sort of live in cycles within cycles within cycles, and you talk about the circadian rhythms. So we've got this BRAC rhythm going on. We've got our 90-minute dream cycle with its four stages of sleep. And then on top of all that, or in the midst of all of that, we've got the circadian rhythms. And you had some things to talk about how those might play into sleep problems.
Yeah, well, the circadian cycle is another one of the many biological cycles that we have. And it relates to the secretion of various hormones and neurotransmitters at different parts of the 24-hour time cycle that induce either sleepiness in us. So melatonin is the classic example, which is released by the pineal gland. And that induces a tiredness within us, which makes sleep much more likely to happen. And then there are at the other end, let's say when we're close to waking up in the morning, there are other hormones and neurotransmitters that are released in order to get us to wake up. And these occur on a fairly regular sort of patterned basis across the 24-hour time frame. So we get used to, so I generally go to bed, 10:30, probably fall asleep around, read for a while and fall asleep.
Yeah, same for me.
I'm getting tired around 10 o'clock at night. So that's my circadian cycle beginning to induce this tiredness within me. And I'm generally waking up 6 o'clock in the morning, and I've got the corresponding part of the circadian cycle is releasing other hormones and neurotransmitters in order to get me to wake up. So we fall into these very regular kind of patterns, which for most people don't really constitute a problem until, let's say, we go to a different hemisphere. So if I travel from Australia to America, I wind up in a different hemisphere. My body clock or circadian cycle is going to be telling me, let's say, in your evening, it's going to be my body's telling me time to wake up, and it's going to be releasing all the wakey up hormones and neurotransmitters. And then when your body clock is telling you in the morning it's time for you to get up, my body clock's going to be telling me it's time to wind down to go to sleep. So it takes about 7 to 10 days for that circadian cycle to begin to adapt to the hemisphere that you find yourself in. So anybody that's travelled to different hemispheres would have had this experience. But also shift workers, people that do shift work for many years, you know, they might start work at 12 o'clock at night or 1 o'clock in the morning, their circadian cycle gets well and truly into that swing of, you know, perhaps waking up, becoming alert at, say, 11 o'clock at night when everybody else is winding down to go to sleep and their sleepy hormones and neurotransmitters are being released into them, you know, 7 o'clock in the morning when they come home, they go to bed at 9 o'clock in the morning, that sort of thing. So shift workers can struggle, particularly, well, I think they can struggle while they're doing these odd hours, but when they finish the shift work, often people will, you know, they'll stay in that sleep pattern even though it doesn't suit them anymore, and requires a very conscious effort to begin to manually shift those gears.
Yeah, I wonder if people who travel a lot for business or shift workers, that must have some impact on their health at some point, I would think.
Yeah, I believe it does. I have read research. I can't remember what it's revealing off the top of my head, but I have read research about the negative health impacts of shift work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised. One of the things that you talk about is the context of sleep. So tell us a bit about that. What are you getting at there?
Okay, so what I'm referring to there is all the different kind of conditions that people need to have in order to make sleep a possibility and a rewarding experience. And we all differ. So there's a great range of variety in this. It refers to the kind of temperature that people need to have in order to sleep, mm-hmm. the amount of coverings that they need to have on their bed. It's not unusual if it's a male and female bed partners to have different body temperatures. Men's body temperatures tend to be higher on average than women's body temperatures are, so it's not unusual for women to need more bed coverings. That all gets reversed when women are going through menopause and all of a sudden they want to have a fan on in the middle of winter and the hot flushes and all that sort of thing going on. So there's these different requirements in terms of just general temperature, different requirements in terms of the amount of light or darkness that people require. Background noise. Some people can cope with a lot of background noise, some other people can't cope with much at all. So these are the kind of environmental factors that people need to take into consideration. And of course, when we're sharing a bed with another person, with our partner, you know, the room for, well, because there can be real differences between individuals, the room for potential conflict is there. And that needs to be negotiated. We need to somehow work out the optimal range of factors required.
Yeah, one partner might be a big snorer, for example, right? And that could lead to some issues and problems. What about the impact of all the, you know, I was talking about my computer and going upstairs and getting my mind engaged. What about the impact of all these devices that we have in our lives these days? How do they relate to sleep? Or interfere or create problems.
Yeah, it's having a massive, massive impact. I think particularly with young people, with children and adolescents, I think people, as people mature to, you know, well into adulthood and middle age and beyond, my impression, and I could be wrong, and of course I'm speaking gross generalizations here, there's always going to be exceptions, but most mature people are generally able to keep their screen time in some kind of balance and some kind of check. So what goes with maturity is the ability to maybe put off the immediate rewards that screens can give us and begin to plan and, you know, strategize our time and all that sort of stuff and begin to see where imbalances are occurring and try to rectify the imbalances and all that sort of thing. And plus the fact is that we didn't grow up with this technology. So for us, it's, you know, it's great, new and exciting technology, but we didn't grow up in our formative years of it being right there for us. Whereas young people, children and young people now are growing up with screens, small mobile screens. I sometimes see little toddlers being pushed around in prams carrying screens and looking on mobile phones.
Wow.
And stuff like that. And what it's resulted in is a generation of young people, teenagers and adolescents and people into their 20s as well, who routinely, it is just simply normal for them to be available to the world literally at all times of the night, at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, the majority of adolescents are still accessible to their friends, and they're still sending messages to each other, you know, supposedly at bedtime while they're meant to be sleeping. And that is, it's enormous. It's massively disruptive. If your sleep time is a time of potential reward, which is what happens every time a new message comes in on somebody's phone, or a new picture of what friends are doing, or the latest post of what's happening, it's a highly rewarding experience. People learn to look forward to receiving the next message, so it becomes a highly addictive process with, you know, with more than likely surges of dopamine being splashed around in the brain with every new rewarding experience that happens.
Yeah, and, you know, I don't know if you saw, I don't know if you get the show 60 Minutes there that we do on Sundays, but the fact that there are neuroscientists, psychologists who specialize in neuroscience, who are paid to make these electronic devices as, quotes, engaging, we might say addictive or engaging as possible. So they're using gamification techniques and so on to, you know, and so young people who don't have the sort of internal constraints that you were talking about earlier, they haven't built those up yet. I
think it's an absolute disaster. And obviously the neuroscientists that are working on that have succeeded beautifully. They've created this beast that is highly addictive and is always screaming out to be interacted with. And what that does to the sleep, it just completely shoots to ribbons the sleep patterns of the primarily young people and adolescents that have totally hooked into it, so that they're getting disrupted sleep. They're getting small patches of sleep through the night. And, you know, the results of this are the lack of the memory consolidation process that I referred to earlier, which is really our nightly psychotherapy session that we need to have in order to be able to function psychologically. Mm. And I'll just take a brief detour here. The way that I make sense of what goes on is, the analogy I give my clients is, imagine your mind as being something like a very busy workspace. And during the day, we have newspaper articles, we have clips that we want to see, we have bits of books that we want to read, we have little projects that we're working on, a lampshade that we're fixing. We've got all these things that we're doing, kind of building up and up and up on this workspace. And at the end of the day, at nighttime, what we need to do is we need to clear the space. We need to throw away the bits of rubbish into the bin, get rid of that half-eaten sandwich, finish off that project, put it away, put the book back in its bookshelf, and kind of clear the space for another day. Well, that's what our mind or brain does while we're dreaming each night. So during the day, our mind is getting cluttered with all the input, all the things that are happening. And dreams seem to be the process by which our mind or brain does the decluttering. And so brings down that clutter on the workspace, and we're ready for the next day.
Mm-hmm. You know, and we say, let me sleep on it. And I've many times myself had the experience of feeling overwhelmed by something that needs to be figured out or whatever, a work problem, and then waking up the next morning and everything falls into place. Yeah. And, geez, it's not so overwhelming as I thought.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's lots of sleep research going back into the 60s demonstrating the necessary function of non-REM sleep for our physical recharging of our batteries, but the REM sleep for our psychological digestive processing of experience, basically. Mm-hmm. So when young people are missing out on that, and they are, you know, many, many adolescents are missing out on adequate sleep, so they're REM-deprived, their workspace is not being decluttered every night adequately. It builds up and up and up. It's not being reduced as is meant to be happening. And that's going to result in, or does result in, the inability to process new information. So it's going to result in cognitive impairments, the inability to basically get the gist of their experiences, whether it be in a scholastic sense, with their studies or just social, the gist of what's going on socially, and being able to process and file away the gist of those experiences into their memory system, it's going to lead to increased moodiness, you know, decreased emotional stability, more propensity for conflict, more propensity for risk-taking, stupid risk-taking behaviour, even in addition to what's normal. Taken to its extreme, sleep deprivation or, you know, REM deprivation can lead to even psychotic-type symptoms in people, whereby people can become quite paranoid, they can become delusional, they can become highly agitated, somewhat aggressive, etc. So, you know, what's happening to the current generation of young people, I think, is nothing short of an evolutionary disaster. I honestly don't know where it's going to end. My hope is that the current crop of young people, when they mature in age, they're going to be able to change what they're doing and maybe catch up on what they've missed out on. But, you know, this is such a new phenomenon. I don't think anybody really knows the long-term consequences of this yet for a generation. I think we're okay because we didn't grow up like that. We didn't grow up with interruptions to our capacity to sleep. But this highly interrupted sleep pattern is the new normal. It's not an aberration. Yeah.
And not just interrupted sleep, but interruptions during the day. I mean, that's changed as well, as our daytimes are much more interrupt-driven than they used to be. We used to focus on something for long periods of time, but now our phone is, you know, we're getting texts and phone calls, and, you know, we're a distracted society. I was talking to a neighbor today. We were both lamenting that we see in our rearview mirrors that the person behind us when we're in our car is texting or actually reading a book or the newspaper or something like that.
Yeah.
I don't know if that happens in Australia. But I've seen that over and over again, and I will be stuck in traffic, and I see that the person behind me is doing distracted driving. They're clearly texting. They're looking down, and I'm looking at my mirror, and I would like to change lanes, but I'm stuck. And I'm getting stressed out.
yeah, for sure. I guess the other thing is that, you know, while young people are probably REM-deprived and sleep-deprived because of their screen usage, our generation, older people, possibly or quite likely REM-deprived through very different reasons. So I've got no idea what the statistics are in America, but in Australia, the average Australian adult has 15 standard drinks of alcohol per week, which means around 2-point-something drinks per night, which is not a whole lot. It's not enough. It's nowhere near, you know, alcoholism or anything like that. But we only need 2 standard drinks per night to interfere with REM sleep, to inhibit our REM sleep. What that means is that the average Australian is REM deprived.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, with statistics, you know, some people are going to be drinking a whole lot more. There's going to be big standard variation from the mean. But still, there's a lot of people that are REM deprived through substance use. So we have alcohol that inhibits REM sleep. Cannabis also inhibits REM sleep. A lot of people suggest that smoking cannabis or consuming it in any way enhances their sleep. Research that was recently done, somewhere at one of the American universities. I've got some cheat sheets here, but I can't get it right. It doesn't really matter where it was done. But it found that people that were using cannabis to enhance their sleep actually got worse scores on insomnia scales than those that weren't using cannabis to sleep. So cannabis also inhibits REM sleep. I believe the statistics are that 1 in every 6 Americans are on psychiatric drugs, 1 in every 11 or 1 in every 10 are on antidepressants. Well, so if 1 in every 10 is on an antidepressant, that's going to be inhibiting REM sleep. Most people these days are on SSRI antidepressants. They inhibit about 30% of REM sleep. if people are on the older types of antidepressants, the tricyclic antidepressants, they inhibit about 50% of REM sleep, and the older antidepressants, MAO inhibitors, also inhibit around 100% of REM sleep. And then the other psych drugs that people are using would be, you know, antipsychotic drugs, which are major tranquilizers. They inhibit REM sleep. Minor tranquilizers, benzodiazepines, they inhibit REM sleep, and also sleeping tablets, which also inhibit REM sleep. So whether it be through alcohol or cannabis or prescription drugs, there's many, many adults in our culture that are also REM deprived. Now, they may be getting an adequate amount of sleep. They may be sleeping 6.5 to 8 hours per night, but there are many adults that are also REM deprived, and that's going to cause the same kind of problems as it does with young people that are REM deprived through screen time.
Yeah.
So, you know, we're not decluttering that workspace of our mind each night, and that causes ongoing emotional problems.
Yeah. And what about Ambien and that class of medications? I don't know if it falls into one of the categories that you mentioned or not.
Yeah, well, that's a sleeping tablet. I think the generic name of that is Zolpidem, and that's marketed as Stilnox in Australia and Ambien in America. And that's the most prescribed sleeping tablet.
Yeah, and I know people that are... they have been taking those for years. For, you know, I can understand doing it to get through a brief period that's exceptional, might have some usefulness there, but to become dependent on it is probably a really bad thing.
Yeah, it's not a great thing. It's, you know, the pharmaceuticals or any substance that has the ability to alter our central nervous system is more than likely going to have an effect on reducing the amount of REM sleep. So, again, people may be getting the right amount of sleep, but they're missing out on the right type of sleep that actually we all really need in order to psychologically function.
Okay.
So there's research done in the University of New South Wales between 2001 and 2011. Well, they collected the data from unexpected and violent deaths between that 10-year time frame. And what they found was that in one-third of the cases, Zolpidem or Ambien was implicated in around one-third of the deaths of violence and violent and unexpected deaths. And the main researcher of that study suggested that Ambien or Zolpidem should not be viewed as being a safe drug as a result of that. And whenever there are either violent or unexpected deaths, then coroners really need to look into whether Ambien is or Zolpidem is part of the equation there. Other research has shown that, and this is particularly disturbing, and I guess you've got to be careful about who you share this information with or how you share it perhaps, because it is very disturbing. But researchers found with a population sample of about 10,000 people that were matched with controls, a control group of about 20,000 people, so we're talking large samples of people, those that were using either the benzodiazepines like Valium, minor tranquilizers, or sleeping tablets like Zolpidem or Ambien had up to a 5 times greater chance of dying from all causes, including cancer and heart disease and all the other things that knock people off, compared to those that weren't using minor tranquilizers or sleeping tablets. Now, again, that's a really disturbing statistic. It appears that, and there was a dose-dependent relationship. So when people only used a very small amount or very occasionally used either a minor tranquilizer or a sleeping tablet, then the relation there was an elevated risk of death of by any cause. But as they increased the amount of use of the pharmaceutical, the risk of death increased, kept on multiplying, it ended up being 5 times greater the risk of death.
Wow.
That's a really disturbing statistic.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's get into some of your recommendations for helping people get to sleep, your non-drug, non-medical, non-pharmaceutical recommendations. And these are all things that you've explored both with your clients and with yourself as you've struggled with these issues. You know, one that I've been skeptical about that you touch on is homeopathy. So, you know, being a psychologist, we get all we're taught to be skeptics. And so tell us what your experience with homeopathy has been for yourself and for patients.
Well, I share your skepticism, and I wouldn't say that I'm over it yet either. I've always been highly skeptical of homeopathy, but I think my wife might have bought some homeopathic melatonin tablets, and in desperation one night I thought I'd give them a go, and I've had zero confidence in homeopathy, but I thought I'd give them a go. And now the idea being that the amount of melatonin in this tablet, like with all homeopathic treatments, has been so reduced. They go through this reducing process. It's been so reduced that there's no traceable element of the melatonin left in there. Well, there's very, very minor that it couldn't possibly have an impact. And these tablets basically contain either, you know, a minuscule trace of melatonin or none of it. And what did I find? I found that if I woke up early in the morning, I felt kind of dopey, far less alert than what I otherwise would, and I was much more likely to sleep through till like 6:30 or 7 o'clock in the morning, which, you know, I'd say it shocked me because I've got almost zero confidence in homeopathy. And I tried it again and again, and I kept on having the same experience, that it just seemed to have this impact. Now, I know that I can't extrapolate from my experience, a case study of one, across to the general population, and I can't say this definitely works because I know too much about science to be able to make that kind of statement. But my personal experience was that it definitely had seemed to have a physiological impact. Now, I'm also aware that it could be a placebo effect. And somebody might say, but, you know, I didn't have any faith or any confidence that in homeopathy that it was going to have the result. I'm also aware of research that shows that people can know that a substance is a placebo and it can still have the placebo effect.
Yeah.
So more recent research on placebos is showing that they can say to somebody, this is an inert substance, it has no medicinal properties whatsoever, but some people have reported that it works well for them. It gets rid of their headache or it gets rid of their stomach ache or whatever. Give it a go and see what happens. And a certain percentage of people are going to get the placebo result, even though they know it's only a placebo.
Isn't that fascinating? That's so fascinating.
You know, like if we know that somebody else has had a positive experience with it, then we put our optimistic bias kind of puts us into that category. Well, we may also have a positive experience with that. It doesn't really matter what causes it, as long as we have that positive experience. So I'm aware that my experience with a homeopathic melatonin tablet may be a placebo, but it worked for me, and I've shared that with other people. It seems to work for them as well.
Yeah, so and I know lots of people that swear by homeopathy, and I think I actually have one here. I can't believe it. Coldies are kind of cough drops that people swear by as shortening their colds.
Yeah.
I don't know if they've read the label to see that, in fact, it is a homeopathic thing, but they take it just like other cough drops out there, except they think it's a lot more effective and powerful.
Yeah.
I had a cold that lasted a long time, and so I was driven to desperation. So that's how I happened to have one left over here.
And you don't have a cold now. There you go. It works.
Yeah. Right. It only took 8 weeks, but
I must say, in fairness to homeopathy, after my surgery, well, before the surgery and afterwards, my wife got me a homeopathic drops to take for, you know, surgical recovery, and my recovery went really well. So, you know, there may be more to it than what I'm willing to acknowledge. Perhaps I'm open to that possibility as well.
Okay. Now, you mentioned another thing that I had never heard of. I don't even know how to pronounce it. The Buteyko method? How do you say that?
That was a...
How's it pronounced?
Buteyko.
Oh, I guess I'm getting close.
You're pretty close, yeah. It was devised by a Russian physician, surnamed Buteyko, in, I think, the 50s and the 60s. And essentially a set of breathing exercises which is primarily used to treat respiratory disorders like asthma and chronic rhinitis, hay fever. I've never had asthma, so I didn't approach it with that in mind, but it also has some implications for the ability to sleep well at night. And it's a set of breathing exercises. Basically, in a very brief nutshell, what Buteyko was saying was that we tend to breathe too much. We gulp in too much air, with the assumption being that our standard assumption is that the more air that we breathe in, the more oxygen is going to reach our body cells. Where in fact, apparently, it's an inverse relationship. The more air we breathe in, the less oxygen arrives at our body cells. The less air that we breathe in, the more oxygen arrives at our body cells. Hmm. It's quite complex.
Yeah, it sounds paradoxical.
It's mostly applied to respiratory disorders, but it has got good implications for sleep, which I've tried. In fact, I had chronic rhinitis, just year-round hay fever, and I successfully got rid of it using this Buteyko method, which I learned through a weekend workshop, which people could find out on the net. But also it does have implications for sleep. It's about retraining your brain to cope with less air that we're sucking in and to try to retrain ourselves to stop breathing through our mouths, which is hard to do when we're talking, but to breathe primarily through our nose in order that our body cells wind up with more oxygen. And there's complex relationships between oxygen and carbon dioxide in our body.
I'm not surprised to hear that a breathing type exercise would be helpful, because for one thing, it would interfere with the worry merry-go-round in our brain, you know, where we can't calm our brain down. And so I know that, for example, progressive relaxation going through your body and tensing up and then relaxing and so on, that can be very helpful in my experience with getting to sleep. Something that you spend a fair amount of time on is energy psychology for sleep and EFT, or emotional freedom technique. And for me, those have been a little bit on the borderline of skepticism. Well, probably a lot on the borderline of skepticism for me, at least in terms of what the explanatory mechanism is for how they work, why they work. Yeah. So tell us a bit about that and your experience.
Okay. Well, energy psychology it's a broad term that covers, I think it's about 10 or 15 different intervention types. And what they share is basically it's a combination of Western psychology in terms of exposure therapy, along with some kind of intervention generally derived from an Eastern treatment modality like acupuncture or acupressure or something like that. And EFT, emotional freedom techniques, is basically tapping on genuine acupuncture points while the person has in their mind and they're reciting a phrase about the thing that they're wanting to change, the problematic aspect of their experience that they're wanting to change. So that's the exposure aspect. Now, in terms of making sense of why would that work? How on earth could that possibly have a positive impact? Well, research is showing very clearly that according to, say, the American Psychological Association standards of what constitutes an efficacious treatment, EFT has been demonstrated through randomized control trials, independently done, to be an effective treatment for phobias, anxieties, depression, and PTSD. So the runs are on the board in terms of the evidence is there that clearly it does work. It's been demonstrated to work. In America, you have a US government National Registry of Evidence-Based Programs and Practices, and they have declared thought field therapy, which is another variation like EFT, as a validated treatment approach. And EFT is expected to be validated by them shortly, just in terms of the amount of randomized controlled trials that they have accumulating. It seems to take, on average, in the vicinity of 15 to 20 years for a new intervention approach to develop the sufficient evidence to be granted an evidence-based status. And EFT is close to reaching that time. So there's there's David Feinstein, who's one of the main sort of researchers of the EFT, reported in 2012 that there were 18, at that point, 18 randomized controlled trials of EFT.
Whom I interviewed, by the way, about that article. Yeah, in the American Psychologist. He was the first person to get an article on this and that rather prestigious publication. He had to rewrite it. Yeah. To meet all the demands of getting in there, but it finally did.
Well, definitely. I haven't heard that interview, but I'll seek it out. Yeah. And definitely that. So the evidence is there. Okay, so how to make sense of why it works. The people that originated these type of approaches made sense of it in terms of traditional Chinese medicine ideas of meridians, of flow lines of energy running through the body, where the ki or chi or life energy is running through, and the idea is if there's a blockage somewhere, it creates a backlog and that creates problems for us. I'm not trained in traditional Chinese medicine. I'm not saying it's wrong. It's just not the language that I use to make sense of the human organism. Mm-hmm. And it may just simply be a different language to describe the same thing, and it's just not a language that I'm familiar with. So it's not the way that I use to make sense of it. It appears that there's research that suggests that in terms of meridians, of course, Western science can't identify any flow line of energy, okay? However, there's an 80% correlation between intramuscular channels in connective tissue and the meridians. So that's a fairly high degree of correspondence, and it may very well be that these intramuscular channels have a heightened sensitivity to stimulation, which then have an impact on the brain. And this is where it comes into my understanding or how to make sense of why something like EFT works. If we have a particular, let's address the sleep issue. Let's say we've got a lot of sleep anxiety, which is where people wind up with. The whole issue of sleep can be so frustrating and so difficult for people. It ends up being a highly anxiety arousing, you know, area in their life.
Right.
And they're full of anxiety. Well, you know, there's parts of the emotional brain that are highly activated when that anxiety is triggered. So going to bed, time thinking, am I going to sleep tonight? How horrible it's going to be tomorrow if I can't sleep? Well, they're in that state. They're in that triggered state just by virtue of going to bed. And the emotional brain, the limbic system is highly active. Probably the amygdala within their limbic system is highly active. There's so much chemical electrical activity going on there, it's just not conducive to sleep. It's conducive to arousal, not conducive to winding down. And EFT starts with a verbal phrase about the thing that you're wanting to change. So you need to recite to yourself a statement about, let's say, feeling anxious about going to sleep. Because that's very real, it taps into what's going on in the emotional brain. Now, when we're doing the tapping procedure, we tap on different genuine acupuncture points. Right now, I'm doing a motor activity. So in order for me to do a motor activity, there are parts of my premotor cortex, my left hemisphere, that become activated. Then the motor cortex becomes activated in order to get me to do a motor activity. At the same time, I've got nerve endings that are receiving stimulation. And so that's sending messages up to my sensory cortex, and my sensory cortex is receiving the nerve stimulation. And it's wondering, well, what's this about? Is it painful? No. Is it sharp? No. Is it hot? No. Is it cold? No. Is it dangerous? No, probably not. Do I need to worry about it? No, I don't need to worry about it. Next spot, so it goes through the same kind of decision-making process. So just by virtue of doing the tapping and receiving the stimulation, there are different parts of my brain that are becoming stimulated at the same time as when I'm stimulating the limbic system with the verbal phrase about feeling anxious about sleep. And it would seem the way that I make sense of it is that the analogy that I use, if anybody's ever lived on a dirt road, which many of your listeners may not have, during very heavy rain, water will go across the lowest point of the dirt road and it'll cut a channel across the road. And, of course, every time it rains, the water will just go through that channel. Now, that's like a very well-traveled neurological path. If we're stressed about sleep, we're anxious about sleep, the neurons are lining up in a certain pattern and it becomes a very well-traveled path, which is like the channel across the dirt road. And every time it rains, the water's just going to go down that channel, or the chemical electrical activity is just going to go whizzing around that particular pathway of neurons. If you want to fix the road, you get what we call a matic, or you might call it a pickaxe or something like that, I think, and you dig what are called feather drains, dispersing water away from the road. So there's small drains that take it away. And so the next time it rains, the water will be dispersed away from the road down the feather drains. And that's similar to when I'm doing this tapping procedure. Okay, so I've got the channel, I've got the deep channel that's of sleep anxiety that's been well established. And when I'm doing that and I'm activating that through the verbal phrase that I'm reciting, repeating that, and when I'm doing the tapping procedure, I'm stimulating different parts of my brain that are outside of the limbic system. It's away from the amygdala.
Yeah.
It's like it's cutting these feather drains to the different parts of the brain so that, let's say, if every brain, this is a brain cell and this is a brain cell, it's got 7,000 to 10,000 tentacles, axon and dendrites coming off them, and there's a very well-traveled pathway that all the chemical activity goes down. When we're stimulating different parts of the brain, we're stimulating areas up here, these can form alternative neural pathways to the areas that are being stimulated. And, of course, when the chemical electrical activity is coming around, it doesn't necessarily have to go down that well-traveled path. It can begin to go up these newly established neural pathways as well. And these can act like the feather drains that then dissipate the intensity of the chemical electrical activity away from the well-traveled path out to these other alternative neural pathways that don't do anxiety. So the other parts of the brain that do different things.
Okay, so I want to jump in here because I'm going to be concerned about time. And I was surprised to discover that you identify yourself as an EMDR therapist.
Yeah.
And somehow I didn't know that before from our other previous interactions. And EMDR stands for eye movement, desensitization, reprocessing.
Is that right?
You might be interested to know I interviewed Francine Shapiro as well some years ago.
Right.
It seems like, might there be the same kind of process working but just rationalized in a different way between EMDR and EFT?
Could very well be. Look, the reality is that on a neurological level, nobody knows why talk therapy works, why just simply talking to another human being about what you've been through has any positive impact. We know that it works, but on a neurological level, nobody knows why that works. We don't demand that general counselling or talk therapy be able to justify itself neurologically, but with interesting and innovative therapies like EMDR and EFT, there seems to be a demand to be able to explain exactly what's going on neurologically. There are very good educated, probably beyond guesses, observations about what is more than likely going on neurologically with both EMDR and EFT, but nobody can say with any absolute total certainty. You know, we can look so far into the brain with brain imaging, but not totally. So the model that I just gave about why EFT may work is purely just a simplistic model, and it's a theoretical proposed model. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying this is the way it is. Nobody really knows. So the relationship between EFT and EMDR could very well be the process of memory reconsolidation. I know you've interviewed Bruce Ecker before on a few occasions, and if people want to find out more about memory reconsolidation, it's very worth listening to those interviews with Bruce Ecker or reading his book. I can't remember the title, Unlocking the Emotional Brain, a fantastic book that I think every therapist mm-hmm. should read.
Mm-hmm.
Memory reconsolidation is a form of neuroplasticity which has the capacity to take the emotional charge out of memories and experiences that people have. So the memory will remain intact, the autobiographical memory will remain intact. But if memory reconsolidation has been launched by the therapeutic process, which requires specific steps, the emotional sting will be taken out of that memory or the experience. And I suspect that both EFT and EMDR probably work by launching memory reconsolidation. And that's a whole other
That really is. And because the EMDR, as I, and it's probably evolved a lot. One of the things that kind of opened me up to EMDR is Francine Shapiro. When I interviewed her, she sent me a book, a big thick book that was all research papers about EMDR. And so I had, before getting that book, I was very much on the skeptical side, and you know, and then when I saw that, wow, a ton of research has been done on this and seems to validate it. So that kind of opened me up to the idea that here's something that works. And the thing that seems similar to me is, is there some kind of a, whether it's tracking a person's eye movements with your finger, which is, I think, how she started out. And then I gather there are machines now that can maybe simulate that sort of thing. And is there also, as with the EFT, some phrases or something that are being rehearsed?
Yeah.
So in both cases, it seems like we're getting the brain engaged in a different way that sort of interrupts whatever program is running in the person's brain, and we're focusing them away from the way that they typically think about whatever the problem is that they're trying to deal with.
Yeah, it could be what they refer to as a dual focus of attention. So in EMDR, we've got the person to reactivate the neural networks relating to the distressing memory or the distressing experience. So that's become reactivated within them. And once that's happened, we then provide an external focus of attention. So part of their awareness is external to what's going on in the environment. Part of it's internal to what's going on in that neural network. And it seems that combination of both internal and external at the same time seems, as you said, disrupt the normal cascade of, the fight or flight cascade that people find themselves in. And it could very well be with EFT, we're doing a similar thing with the verbal phrase. We're reactivating the neural networks around the distressing experience that we're wanting to work on. At the same time, that's the internal focus. Then the external, we're creating almost like an environmental form of stimuli as well, which creates a dual focus of attention and, again, can disrupt that normal fight or flight cascade.
Mm-hmm.
So that could very well be what it's about. Both EMDR reports, research reports that many people find that form of bilateral stimulation when they're moving their eyes backwards and forwards, seems to induce a calmed central nervous state. Okay, so it seems to settle things down. And there's also research that suggests that the tapping procedure deactivates the amygdala. So it seems to dampen the distress state of the amygdala. So both the forms of stimulation, EMDR and EFT, seem to be deactivating, depotentiating the central nervous system, just settling it down.
Yeah.
And that can be the disruption which, as per memory reconsolidation, if the person has that distressing memory or experience activated, and then they have in the same field of consciousness a very different experience, one of being calm at the same time as having that activated, then this juxtaposition seems to launch memory reconsolidation, which apparently allows the neural pathway to eliminate the emotional distressing aspect of that experience. So the person will still remember it, but with less of that emotional sting.
Yes. Yeah, that's a good summary, I think.
Okay.
If people want to find out more about this, there are some interviews that I did, which you made reference to. I want to refer you again to Dr. Alexander's book here. You also offer a tape through your website that helps people go to sleep. And if you want to give a little promo for that, you're welcome to do it.
It's a guided imagery recording, an MP3 recording that people can order. And obviously I can send them the link and they can download it onto their device. First 15 or 20 minutes or so, I'm talking about the nature of sleep. I'm talking about, I'm guiding people onto a lovely beach scene and you hear the waves and the sound effects of the waves and all that sort of stuff. And then I talk about the wave nature of sleep and the rest activity cycle and how sleepiness comes to us in waves. And we've got the sound of the waves happening and all that. And then I take them for a walk off the beach into a lovely rainforest next to the beach, where they walk through the rainforest and we're hearing bird sounds and frogs and crickets, things like that. And they arrive next to a little waterfall where they find a lovely moss-covered rock that they can lay down on, and they're listening to the water. And the lovely sound effects continue. My voice cuts out after 15 or 20 minutes, which is a good thing, and the lovely sound effects continue. And it's all backed by this incredible piece of music that I got a local musician to make for me for this purpose. And it's quite an amazing piece of music. I don't know how to describe it other than it's a non-lineal piece of music. It just seems to go around in some kind of swirls and circles. Beautiful and relaxing piece of music. So that's running in the background along with these lovely nature sounds. And the whole thing goes for about, I think it goes to close to about 90 minutes. And so people can easily put that on the last hour or so. It's going to be the lovely music that keeps on recycling and the lovely nature sounds. So it's a really nice way, it's a nice circuit breaker if people's minds are just going 1,000 miles an hour and they can't sleep.
Sure.
And also, as I say in the book, EFT is a great circuit breaker as well in that circumstance too.
Yeah. So what is your website where people can find that?
www.doctor, which is just Dr. James Alexander, all one word, all lowercase. That's drjamesalexander-psychologist.com.
Ah, dash psychologist. Okay. Great. Yep. I'm going to have to check that out myself.
The book's available both from my website and also from Amazon.com.
Okay. Well, Dr. James Alexander, it's always a delight to communicate with you. We made some music together, too, virtually, and I may play that at the end of this show on the audio podcast. We had fun with that. So I want to thank you for being my guest here again, and hopefully not the last time.
Thank you, Dave. It's a real pleasure for me every time I speak with you, and it's just wonderful to be able to see you when we're talking this time.
Getting a good night's sleep is fraught with anxiety and frustration for so many of us. As I remarked in the interview, I have friends and acquaintances who have been hooked on Ambien and similar substances for years. I think when it first came out, Ambien was presented as a very benign solution. I found it quite helpful on long-haul flights to Europe. Of course, I might have slept just fine without it. I generally am able to fall asleep quite easily on planes, especially if I can get the window seat on the right-hand side of the plane. I'm just so used to sleeping on my right side that being able to lean to my right is essential to my routine. So, as I was saying, I might have slept fine without the Ambien. I suspect it was more of an emotional crutch against the fear that I would not be able to sleep, or more precisely, stay asleep for the usual number of hours. That's an issue that unfortunately I didn't bring up in the interview. I'm under the impression that there are two kinds of people when it comes to sleep problems: those who have trouble falling asleep, and those who fall asleep easily but have difficulty sleeping as long as they would like. Both of these issues can be quite vexing to those who suffer from them. Off and on, I've experienced both, but thankfully, neither has been a chronic problem. Getting back to air travel, the Ambien seemed more important on the return flights from Europe than the outbound flights to Europe. I assume it has something to do with our circadian rhythms. Typically, when I've traveled to Europe from my California home, the flight takes off in the evening a few hours before the time I'd normally be going to sleep anyway. There's just enough time to get settled in, have dinner, maybe watch a movie, and then it's easily off to beddy by. By contrast, the flights back from Europe are typically in the morning when my brain is in wake-up mode. I might be able to nap a bit in the beginning of the flight, but then my brain wakes up and I can't get back to sleep, and I'm totally wiped out and out of it by the time I arrive home, painfully so. So that's why Ambien is particularly tempting for that return flight. However, there have been a number of disturbing stories in the news that really have given me pause about that. Maybe you've also read the news stories about people who flip out, to use a technical term, and then have no recollection of the disturbance they caused. So it's been some years since I've flown to Europe. I'll have to see if I can resist the Ambien temptation. Incidentally, we did discuss the use of melatonin for long-haul flights, and that's something I've experimented with in terms of adjusting my inner clock to deal with the time zone shifts, and I think it's been helpful. In general, however, I have to agree with Dr. Alexander that sleeping pills are best avoided and that we should learn to rely on psychological strategies instead. Getting back to the interview, I think we opened up an interesting kettle of fish in our discussion of energy psychology and the possible relation to EMDR. We probably could have spent the whole show on that. At the same time, I think Dr. Alexander did an excellent job of exploring those issues in the time that we had. The title of the book, again, is Getting the Z's You Want, Sleep Sense in the 21st Century by James Alexander, Ph.D. As usual, if you decide to order this book, I encourage you to use the Amazon widget in the right-hand sidebar on our website.
Welcome to Dr. Dave's podcast. Focus on the sound. Breathe deeply. Focus on the sound. Over to that button and make a donation to Dr. Dave's Psychological Metastic Shrink Wrap Radio podcast. Donate now.
Thank you, Phil Schneider, for that very creative appeal for donations. I don't know if it's my hearing, but I had difficulty hearing the voice under the musical parts, but at least the central message comes through. Reach over and click on that donate button. Well, I'm happy to say we do have three new donors since the last episode. Big thanks go out to Frank Zermul. Now, I don't know how to pronounce this German name. Frank Zermulin. Jill Fitzgerald and Sean Dunn. I hope others of you will be inspired to follow their fine example. One piece of news to share with you. I was interviewed this past week for inclusion in an article for the American Psychology Association's magazine, Monitor on Psychology. The article will be about why psychologists should consider becoming podcasters. I'm only one of several psychology podcasters interviewed, but I'm glad for the recognition. I do believe I was the first psychologist podcaster, but I can't prove it. I tried to make that point in the interview, but I don't think it made it into the article. Darn. What? Me have an ego? You've got to be kidding. Well, I've run long today, so I think we will go straight to the wrap-up. As always, you can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. Remember, you can also leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site, and you can leave voicemail on our phone at 415-830-4014, or you can use our app for that, about which you can find full information in the Apps tab on our site. Thanks to today's return guest, Dr. James Alexander, for sharing tips and insights from his new book on sleep. Next week, my guest will be psychologist Dr. Kelly Flanagan, author of the book Lovable, Embracing What Is Truest About You, so you can truly embrace your life. I think we can all use that shot of inspiration. So until next time, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind. Stay tuned for that virtual duet that I mentioned with Dr. James Alexander and yours truly.
I've been doing some hard traveling, I thought you knowed. I've been doing some hard traveling way down the road. With a heavy heart and a worried mind, shrink wrap radios are real defined. I've been doing some hard traveling, Lord. Dave's been doing some good listening, I thought you knowed. Dr. Dave's been podcasting way down the road. With a big fat mic and a soothing voice, you know he's offered you a real good choice. He's been doing some podcasting, Lord. I've been doing some deep traveling, I thought you knowed. I've been doing some deep exploring way down the road. With a happy heart and a bright spirit, life's calling me, ain't gonna fear it. I've been doing some deep traveling, Lord. I've been doing some wide exploring, I thought you knowed. I've been doing some self-exploring way down the road. With Jung and Freud and soul and psyche, Dr. Dave's in my ear to guide. We've been doing some wide traveling, Lord.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.